I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very, very pleased to welcome back into our studios for his monthly visit to the program, Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, author of After the Cold War, and a columnist whose work appears in newspapers, websites across the country, and in other countries as well. And Professor Sear writes on a wide variety of topics. Professor Sear is also responsible for other interesting guests who join us from time to time who come to Carthage at the invitation of the Clausen Center. So we consider him a valued friend to the station and are always happy that we can have him on a monthly basis to talk about all kinds of different issues and topics of interest and concern. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much. You're most gracious. Not a guest from the outside, but one of our colleagues at Carthage recently on your program was Mark Miller.
Yes.
In management and marketing and business, who talked about his new memoir concerning his experiences as a combat infantryman in Vietnam during the war. And I'm particularly grateful to you for having him on.
I'm glad we did. We had an interesting conversation, I think. And
it was very interesting. Yes, very candid.
Yeah. So, well, we have a lot to talk about. And I think actually where we need to begin is with a certain hotly contested presidential campaign. And one of the reasons I want to talk about this is
because, which one is that, Greg?
Yeah, right. One of the reasons I want to talk about that is because one of your more recent columns looked back to 1960 and to the first important televised presidential debates between the sitting vice president, Richard Nixon, the Republican candidate, and of course is the Democratic challenger, John F. Kennedy, who ultimately prevailed by a very tight margin in that election back
essentially
in 1960.
Essentially a dead heat.
Right.
In the popular vote, though, not in the Electoral College,
right,
which is what counts in our system.
Right. As your column pointed out, the two of them engaged in four televised presidential debates. Most people don't know that. They only heard about or seen excerpts from the first. But it was really interesting to think back to that day and to think about some of the sharp contrasts with the campaign that is being waged right now. So I have all kinds of questions swirling around in my head. I want to start with this one. I think a lot of what is being said right now speaks to how America is so very, very sharply divided, maybe more divided than we've ever been in our history. I suspect that you, preferring to take kind of the longer view, the historical view of kind of the present situation, I suspect would not be quite so quick to make such a blunt blanket statement, that there have probably been other times in our history when we have been at least this divided, maybe more divided, and also where there has been this much rancor in the air, that maybe in recent history we're seeing something unprecedented, but through the scope of our history, maybe the high level of tension and rancor in this presidential campaign maybe is not anything at all unique.
No, it's not at all unique, and that's a very important question. As Richard Nixon liked to say, thank you very much for asking that question. 1960 was a time of intense, feverish concern about communism overseas and the Cold War. As I mentioned in the column, Senator Kennedy was quite brazen in driving the debate, which was supposed to be about domestic affairs, and Nixon would occasionally politely bring that up. Kennedy kept driving it into foreign affairs. Informed and knowledgeable people at that time had a kind of uniform consensus that the Soviets were passing us by. Nikita Khrushchev was a particularly belligerent as well as erratic leader, and indeed many of his public statements were quite terrifying, literally, to Americans. We will bury you. And he set off a 50-megaton nuclear explosion. Fortunately, that hasn't been repeated. Kennedy talked about how the Soviets were ahead of us in engineering and education and scientists. They're ahead of us in the space race, superior to us militarily, which was not true, actually. But that's what people believed. And it shows the importance of being skeptical and calm, referring to the conventional wisdom of any time. We were also just finishing 8 years of Dwight Eisenhower's administration, and in hindsight, it's increasingly clear that Ike was a remarkable genius at smoothing over, literally calming people down collectively, and smoothing over partisan differences between the parties. He was a truly effective bipartisan president. Like a lot of really important things, it was only clear after the fact. Nixon had achieved a well-deserved reputation as an absolutely ruthless hatchet man for the Republican Party. He engaged in very personal and very very mean-spirited attacks when he was elected to Congress and also the Senate. And according to some reports, Henry Cabot Lodge, his running mate, the very patrician East Coast Brahmin from the internationalist wing of the Republican Party and a very prominent U.N. ambassador during the Eisenhower years, said to him quietly, "Remember, Dick, people see you as an unpleasant fellow." I'm cleaning up the language. "Make sure you don't confirm that on TV." And, of course, Nixon was much criticized for being, if anything, too polite, very much the Me Too candidate. But if you look at the Truman years, the anti-communist hysteria at that time, and Eisenhower's first few years, I don't think things are any worse today than they were then. Our parties are more ideological, and our political interchange is far more simple-minded and far more personal. But politics has always been a very rough way of making a living and getting ahead.
Right. Well, and of course, if one takes an even longer historical view back into the 19th century, you can find all kinds of indications of one candidate attacking another in ways that just make your head spin.
Racial and ethnic prejudice and hatred defined our politics, not surprisingly. That's part of the human condition historically until actually quite recent years. And beyond the personal insults and references to gender in both directions, implied or explicit, I mean, that has faded to a remarkable degree in American politics. Mm. We can talk about that more if you want, because I'm always ready to talk. But that is really important. We're far more tolerant, far more law-abiding.
Right, and it doesn't, in many ways, it doesn't feel like that. But when you but when you look at the facts, that in fact is the case.
Yeah, of course not.
Yeah. I loved some of your analysis of these Nixon-Kennedy debates, and of course, without doing it in too heavy-handed a fashion, you were, in a sense, drawing a contrast to the debates, the three debates which occurred in this current campaign. One of the things you pointed out, and I never knew this, is that this, at least this first Kennedy-Nixon debate, opened with each of them giving 8-minute introductory remarks. And of course, the idea there is that you can really say something substantive,
yeah,
in 8 minutes. And the format of the debates as they were waged this time around didn't give much in the opportunity for that for either candidate.
Yeah, quite right. I think that's a very central point, as you know as well as I do. And many of our listeners, if not all of them, know our fine young people today are very audiovisual in their approach, and I accommodate that and use it positively, and also get even by showing the students rather old videos, quite ancient and indeed unbelievable and amazing from their point of view sometimes. Mm-hmm. We're currently watching in my political economy class Executive Suite, classic Hollywood film of the mid-50s. And a truly, truly impressive drama with a real plot and complex interplay.
No buildings
very effective.
Exploding.
No, but big, tall skyscrapers really defined business to a significant degree. And that's a very telling scene at the beginning. Capital-like people have become much more fluid and mobile, and in terms of capital, plentiful in our time. And anyway, I show them the Kennedy-Nixon debate. I do that every year, and especially in presidential years. And occasionally a class is swept away by JFK, because he's so magnetic on television. But the consensus, quite strong at this point, I've been doing this for years, is that they're both really very good. Hmm. And students mentioned this year, as in the past, they're extremely polite to each other. They're calm, they're not shouting, and they're not insulting each other.
Nor interrupting each other.
Yeah.
Excuse the interruption.
Right, yes. That's all right. No, later on, after the first debate, it got more heated toward, but not that much compared to today's really crude and vulgar performances. And I'm not just referring to Trump. My response, predictably, given my age and outlook is, well, in those days, that's the way a man had to behave. In the society of that time, if you behaved the way a lot of people do today, you wouldn't be a man. By definition, you'd be something less, considerably less, and not worthy of respect or any deference at all, quite the reverse, which is really true. And it's an interesting. Politicians reflect us. It's an interesting commentary.
So that's one way
how
in which
our
things,
culture has changed.
Right. So it isn't. It isn't that nothing has changed. Some things have changed quite drastically, and there are some ways in which this presidential campaign demonstrates that.
In terms of the public space, what goes on in the public space is extremely important because it defines our community, and a lot of political philosophy, as well as religion, is focused from ancient times on the public space. So I'm not suggesting that the good old days were so great, but rather that what passes for acceptable behavior in public has changed pretty dramatically, especially in this country.
That's for sure. I want to ask you one other thing about the Nixon-Kennedy debates, and then I want to see what you had, what you have to say about these more recent debates and then this campaign in general. One of the things that you point out in your column, and I've read this in other places too, is that among those who watched that first debate, Kennedy was seen as the winner. For those who actually listened to the debate instead on the radio, Nixon came out the winner.
Yeah.
I've always wondered, well, no, no, I haven't. I only wondered for the first time after I read this in your column, actually, this time around. I always just took that at face value that it meant the visual was really important, and so, and that in that respect, Kennedy was far superior to Nixon. So that explains it. But if they hadn't been on TV, Nixon would have won the debate. I kind of wonder if it's possible that that's not a perfectly scientific comparison in that perhaps more people who listened to it on the radio were perhaps older and more conservative. I mean, to begin with, maybe more receptive to what Mr. Nixon would have had to say. And if that might have possibly skewed those numbers in terms of who actually won that debate.
Yes, you're right. By 1960, there was more than one TV set per household in the United States.
Wow.
Incredible. FDR was the first president to appear on television, I believe, during the World's Fair.
I think that's right.
Just before World War II, but he was the great media star and brilliant user of radio. Television was very, very limited in terms of any consumer impact until the 50s, but then it grew exponentially, incredibly. Interestingly enough, a lot of informed people, like Soviet strength in 60, a lot of the most informed people thought radio was going to disappear completely. Unfortunately for you and me and the population at large, that hasn't happened, but you're right. My best information, and it's limited information, is that only one limited survey that I believe was sponsored by more of a PR and consulting firm than a polling company brought this information to the forefront. But you're quite right. It was it's almost universally disseminated today. And I think it is telling. Actually, when you read the transcripts, which I have done, Nixon is much more orderly. His lawyer's training and mental discipline is very, very clear. Kennedy is far more rhetorical and repetitious.
Interesting.
However, Nixon had been going around the country. A principal theme was that I am a senior statesman like the almost divine president in General Eisenhower. Mm. I've been at his right hand. We're making these serious, mature decisions together. And Jack Kennedy, in so many words, he described as this teenager who just gotten his driver's learner's permit. I exaggerate, but not much. And simply by agreeing to appear equally, I believe it's the notorious Roger Ailes who's written in print in his more serious moments that he was able to become an advisor to Nixon because Nixon was really out of it in terms of seeing the tremendous dramatic potential and importance of television. Kennedy, who was often quite candid about himself, especially in private, said more than once he never would have made it without the debates.
Right.
And Nixon seems not to have appreciated that profound importance. They were equals.
Mm.
That's what counted, whoever won or lost. They were seen as equals.
Right. I mean, that screen, that screen split them. I mean,
yeah.
Nixon was there, Kennedy on that the other half of the screen, and there they were, very much in a sense equals. It elevated Kennedy's stature, and if Nixon had not agreed to those debates, all that could have turned out very differently.
And he didn't have to. It was quite unprecedented, and they were so important. LBJ and the later Nixon took a pass. We owe a lot to Gerald Ford as well as John Kennedy, who very graciously agreed to debate the unknown Jimmy Carter, which gets at the other important point. Unbelievable now, but the majority of Americans, I dare say, had no clear impression of who the Democratic nominee was, even though Joseph Kennedy had literally been promoting his son since the Second World War, and his family before, literally, relentlessly, with a brilliant sense of public relations and marketing. Still, Kennedy was vaguely defined, and it's self-evident he sharply defines himself on television.
Mm. Well, let's move to this current campaign. And
if I may make one other point,
sure.
Political economy students tend to be good students, not because of me, but it's a demanding major. And one young woman in this year's class said, I think this is the first time I'd heard it, Kennedy is a better teacher. They were talking about farm policy. Both paid tribute to the farmer, which we don't do anymore.
Right.
That was a decisive and much larger population. Kennedy explicated things in a more understandable way. Nixon tended to get kind of bogged down in the details.
Mm.
And this young woman was extremely, Miss Wickstead, was extremely perceptive.
Interesting. I've never heard that said, but
I
understand that would be true. And, of course, Kennedy also had a way with humor. Not so much in those debates, I suppose, but in other situations. And that, of course, can be a great leavening agent and can contribute to good teaching, of course, too.
Along with Abe Lincoln, I think he was probably our wittiest president.
Yeah.
I mean, a genuinely spontaneous, often brilliant sense of humor.
Well, I don't hear much discussed about the wit of either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, although they each bring, of course, other qualities to the stage. Let's talk first in general, and then I'd be curious also to know anything you feel like you want to say about now the three debates that occurred between them. First of all, just what has your sense been about this campaign and how it has been waged?
I think the one vice presidential debate generally got better reviews. It's been interesting to me how the mass media overall, which I believe has a Democratic bias, as was the case with the TV networks in 1960, in terms of the correspondents who were there, for the first debate especially, the vice presidential debate I didn't think was that great either, and there was a tremendous amount of trading of insults and snide comments after the obligatory kind of verbal blowing of kisses to each other at the beginning and paying respect to each other. Mike Pence didn't say all that much. He spent a lot of his time shaking his head in frustration and not sighing, but clearly visually complaining about statements that about his running mate primarily that were, for the most part, quite true and accurate. It shows the importance of bearing in presence because I think my impression overall is he got far more favorable comments than his counterpart on the Democratic side. I think Kane and Pence both have a good TV presence, but it's interesting. And the vice presidential debates over time have been quite important, including in the Ford-Carter contest of 1976.
So did you
contrary to popular wisdom, I think.
Right. So what about the Trump-Clinton debates? Did you watch them? Were you impressed by anything? I mean, judging from the way you worded your column, I think you felt like it was these were far less significant than, for instance, the weightier debates of 1960.
Yes. It's probably more a sign of age and irritability than wisdom, but I find them unwatchable, and I did not watch all of any of the debates. I mostly listened on the radio, partly because I'm on the road a lot for good old Carthage College, but no, I found them just quite off-putting, and that's me more than anything connected. I mean, it's vital to modern communications, but I have carefully read analysis and some transcripts, and very superficial and very repetitious and intellectually undisciplined on both sides. I think she's far superior in terms of substance, and the Democrats have an advantage because their primary debates actually were relatively serious. The Republicans, it was a collective food fight from the get-go with all these informed and accomplished people overall. And Trump has accomplished significant things, whether you agree with him or not, and it was just awful. Just awful, terrible, and why our system kind of regurgitates this kind of behavior publicly is something we really all should be thinking about and reading about. I hope I don't sound like just one more grumpy old tiresome old man, but it really is a profound commentary on what's acceptable today.
Right. I also did not watch any of the debates start to finish. What I ended up doing, I watched brief portions of each.
Well, but I don't feel so bad.
Right. But then I went to NPR.org and read the complete transcript of all three debates, which also included in real time fact checking, which also occurred, and so that was also really interesting to read. But yeah,
I feel so much better. Thank you.
But thank you, young man. But it felt a little more palatable to read than to watch.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what you think is going on with Donald Trump and the fact that he is still carrying such a wide swath of the American public. I shouldn't say not that his base is a wide variation of people. I mean, I think it's kind of a relatively concentrated demographic, but nevertheless, they are remaining very loyal to him. Those that intend to vote for him are not fleeing the ship the way that many, for instance, prominent Republicans are. What do you think is the most significant hold that Donald Trump has on those that are so fervently loyal to him, and what is there to learn from that?
It goes beyond the issues, and it goes beyond presentation, and it goes beyond the candidate. He's, by any objective measure, not an effective or impressive businessman. He is very much a show businessman, and now for many years, after the disastrous failure of his business career, by a man who inherited an enormous fortune and blew it relatively quickly, despite his father's efforts to rein him in. There are special provisions in the family trust to try to prevent Donald from doing that. But what he got, he, in a very profligate and unwise way, wasted. But he's clearly a genius at using the media, especially television. And in today's dynamic of the more spectacular and exciting, the better, even for commercial networks that see themselves as serious news outlets, he's been able to dominate the discussion from early in the primaries to a remarkable degree. And it's a great tribute to his political skill. To actually answer your question, what he's feeding on is a tremendous and widespread hatred of Washington and the current system. And as you indicated at the start, we are in a very divided period. And I believe our current leadership in different ways has reinforced that.
One of my questions is...
I hope that's clear, because it's too easy to just dismiss him.
Right. One question I have echoes an earlier question, which was taking issue with the idea that we've never been this divided before, and of course...
Well, we have.
Sure. There were 4 years where we were literally divided into two nations.
And, 61 to 65.
Yeah. But even beyond that, of course, we can point to all kinds of periods in our history where there's been great, great division. On the other hand, do you think it is unprecedented for there to be this widespread and intense a distrust and even hatred in some quarters of our government? Is that something we have seen before?
Yes, in our history. I think during the Great Depression, we were on the verge of a very violent political revolution in this country, as I think it's more important than ever to make the point, because there seem to be more and more younger conservatives and neoconservatives, younger from my point of view anyway, who kind of dismiss the New Deal and dismiss the FDR administration for their many and obvious, in hindsight, economic failures and the kind of mismanagement that I think Roosevelt literally forestalled what could have been a return to the Civil War, a very violent domestic revolution. What's distinctive about our period is we're actually doing extremely well. I think it's a good time for somebody to start quoting FDR from, I think, 36, the or a second inaugural. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. That was not true then, but in many ways it is true now. Thank God there has not been a second strike since 2001 in terms of massive terrorism. There have been incidents by basically freelance killers and mass murderers, and those are terrible crimes, but it's not really international terrorism. Unemployment is technically quite low. But despite this, a lot of people still feel great hatred and alienation from Washington especially. A lot of people are not doing as well as they want to economically, even if you have a warm place to stay and you're not going hungry, in great contrast to the 30s. Nonetheless, people feel great hostility. I think the income gulf, which is really quite unfortunate and has been growing since the 70s, is one big factor in that. Beyond that, I don't know. I don't think there's one single explanation, but Americans of a certain age have a right to vote. Too often, media people, intellectuals, too often people like me dismiss his voters, which is a huge mistake. This is a very sizable population, and at some point, they're going to have to be listened to. He's going, if he goes away, he may not go away, but even if he does, if he loses and moves on to other interests, perhaps a new separate television and media network of his own, this sentiment has to be reconciled with the rest of the system.
Right. Well, that's what I was thinking, too.
I hope that's clear. Right. Yeah, because it's too easy just to dismiss this movement, which is a genuine and extreme mass movement.
Right. And if the polls hold true and Mrs. Clinton is elected, without saying it, it's a foregone conclusion, but the numbers do point to that. That huge number of Americans who have this intense antipathy towards our own government, their own government. They're still here,
mm-hmm.
and what a President Hillary Clinton and her administration will do about that might be one of their greatest challenges.
Yeah, and it's going to be a real test of leadership. I believe Bill Clinton was a very successful president in policy terms, and was a remarkable deal maker until his personal behavior and personal stupidity got him in trouble of a serious sort. He was a very active and proactive legislative leader with Congress. His legislative agenda wasn't as enormous as Lyndon Johnson's, but he was right up there with LBJ and Dwight Eisenhower in terms of getting a significant portion of what he wanted through Congress. And we should all sure hope that his wife is equally effective in what I think are durable and pragmatic policy terms.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's going to be interesting to see exactly how the numbers play out and what happens from here. Have you already voted, or do you like to vote on Election Day?
Yes, I always vote, and I'm going to be voting on Election Day.
I think I am, too. I mean, I see the wisdom of voting early, but there's just something that doesn't feel quite the same.
Well, it's important for the people to vote, whether they happen to agree with you and me or not. I tend to be critical of a lot of things in people, like most professors. Like many professors, I'm critical of Mrs. Clinton. Former Secretary Clinton is another celebrity candidate. When she and her husband's flaws are obvious on the financial front especially, and they've been guilty of behavior that I think is really pretty shocking, and that behavior continues. Her legislative record was pretty much non-existent in the Senate. And as Secretary of State, she traveled enormously. It's impossible to point to any significant accomplishment that she initiated, in great contrast to her successor, Secretary Kerry. For that reason, The Economist, the very serious and effective British news and business weekly, which I've been reading since I was a student, just about every week, they have in the current issue, I think the one with Putin is a very complimentary analysis of her ability to work together with other members of the Senate. If it wasn't her sponsored legislation, it was others, but very positive quotes, including from very conservative Republicans, about They found her willing to work together to get things through. And if she is elected, I think that's, and as people are making up their minds, I think that's an important consideration, contrary to what I think and tend to say, in her favor.
In the few minutes that remain to us, we have a couple of other things to talk about. One of them that you wrote about most recently was, two different columns about two different important people, one written in the wake of the death of former Israeli President and Prime Minister Shimon Peres,
right,
and the other, the newly elected new Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, from Portugal.
Yes, indeed.
Let's talk first of all about Mr. Peres. I appreciated how you laid out his legacy, which is in a sense kind of a complex legacy, in which in some ways he was seen as a moderate, and in other ways someone who also was seen in some quarters as a fairly controversial figure. But overall, you seem to paint a very positive picture of who he was and what he represented.
Yeah, the column starts, as I recall, if I recall correctly, with reference to the funeral, the memorial service, and the fact that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his counterpart, the head of the Palestinian Authority, which is, in the eyes of many, a Palestinian state, President Abbas, shook hands. That's very significant. Shimon Peres was, from a very young age, a very dedicated Zionist. He participated in the Israeli Revolution. He was very much a hardliner, at least for a while, concerning settlements. But his overall point of view and his emphasis on reconciliation, personified by these two leaders bitterly at odds at his funeral, came to the fore, in contrast to the much more extreme, from my point of view, and undesirable policies of Netanyahu and Likud on the right. There's a young person, relatively young, I think she's still in her 50s, Zippy Livni, who she's had cabinet posts in Israel. She's a very durable politician who started young. She was an ally of Netanyahu and broke with him quite a long while ago. She participated, I believe, in the last national elections in Israel as part of the Moderate Alliance, and she seems to me to be someone with a future who seems to have a lot of the intellectual gifts and consensus gifts. She seems to me to kind of personify a lot of the qualities of the just-deceased president.
You also had good things to say about Mr. Guterres, a former prime minister of Portugal and a former high commissioner for the UN for refugees. And you talked about how
Guterres from Portugal.
Yes, Guterres. And you talked about how he is succeeding someone from South Korea, Ban Ki-moon,
right,
who was a very solid leader of the United Nations, in contrast to the man that he succeeded, Kofi Annan. And I think the gist of what you're saying there is that you are hoping Mr. Guterres follows more in the footsteps of the man he succeeds than some of the others who have led the UN in stormier fashion.
Yes. I think there are good reasons for optimism for an organization that is extremely important, has been since before the end of World War II, since FDR and Prime Minister Churchill of Britain enunciated in some detail the concept of the United Nations before Pearl Harbor. It was an institution that was divided by the Cold War and also the North-South division between wealthy and poor countries for many, many years. The Cold War has ended, and that North-South division has faded. For most of the Cold War period, the UN reflected of necessity the Third World. Kurt Waldheim from Austria was seen as kind of a more even-handed leader. He was not from the developing world, and then unfortunately it turned out that he'd covered up his role as an SS officer in Europe during World War II, so he left. But I think we're returning to the very earliest years of the UN in terms of there being an opportunity for collaboration. It's now a truly global organization. Ban Ki-moon was a brilliant choice because Korea, over 50 years, has gone from being one of the poorest countries, literally in the world, for many years after the Korean War, and a devastated peasant society and economy to a real powerhouse. And I thought I'm very pro-South Korea anyway, as you know, but he really bridged that divide. And whether it's someone from Africa or someone from Europe, no longer really seems to mean anything. Mm-hmm. I hope that's effective and clear.
Yes, and we will, of course, watch what how he leads the United Nations with great interest. It obviously remains a very, very crucial player on the world stage.
Dag Hammarskjöld from Sweden, a neutral country, pro forma neutral leader, but he was very pro-American and very much on our side, a brilliant leader who was tragically killed in a plane crash. He may have been murdered in 1961. In Africa, since that time, it was really the takeover by the Third World, which in many ways was hostile to the West, mm-hmm. especially the U.S., and understandably so, that defined the U.N., and we seem to be returning to that earlier, much more hopeful time from my point of view. Mm-hmm. Gutierrez gets things done. I mean, the U.N.'s a maddening talk fest. It used to be a punching bag in American politics, partly for that reason. It's one reason Nixon picked Lodge in 1960 from the U.N.
Interesting.
Yeah, but it's... we're in a very promising period compared to that.
Right. To finish out today, I want to tell our listeners that this coming Tuesday, the morning show, will feature an interview with a veteran from the Korean conflict, a man by the name of Grant McMillan, who now makes his home in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. Mr. McMillan is one of about a dozen Korean War veterans who are featured in the next PBS American Experience documentary, which is going to be airing Tuesday night. And that film is called The Battle of Chosin. And Chosin was a really, really critical battle early in that Korean conflict in late 1950. And if all you know about the Korean War is watching MASH on TV, you need to, and I'm there's probably far too many Americans who are in that boat. And I should say I'm embarrassed at how little I know or knew about the Korean conflict until I watched this film. I mean, yep. I watched a little more than from the TV show MASH, but not much more. And this battle was so critical. And the film also kind of talks about the way in which just this battle alone really helped kind of reshape America's sense of what it needed to do in the world and about our heightening fears about the rise of communism. It's a really, really interesting film. Professor Sear, I thought you could maybe just take a moment and just kind of set the stage in terms of how this conflict erupted in the first place. And the critical nature of this particular Battle of Chosin.
On June 25th, 1950, quite unexpectedly, from our point of view, North Korea invaded South Korea, very quickly overran most of South Korea, and UN forces, President Truman quite courageously and rightly intervened, based on UN authority. He just consulted with Congress. Allied forces were driven down to a very small kind of last stand area, I think on the south southwest corner of Korea. And Douglas MacArthur, the overall UN commander, quite brilliantly and daringly launched a sea invasion at Incheon, right, just to the north, relieved the kind of basically the forces that were about to be wiped out completely, and drove steadily north. It was decided after some debate to cross the 38th parallel and retake North Korea.
Largely decided by him, I think.
Yeah, right? He was always pretty imperious, but he became increasingly imperious at that time. He was then in his 70s and had been ruling Japan literally like an emperor since the Japanese surrendered in early September 45. He was a strange combination of great brilliance and an extremely dangerous kind of megalomania. He was increasingly operating on his own. He treated President Truman with considerable disdain, which was really terrible, and Truman finally fired him, not because of that, he tolerated that, but because MacArthur was sounding off more and more. I think he saw himself as a divine figure of history. He felt war would be abolished after we used nuclear weapons to destroy North Korea and China and perhaps the whole evil communist empire. He was quite confident in predicting that the Chinese would never intervene. Around Thanksgiving, 300,000 troops from the People's Liberation Army of China poured over the border. They had been saying publicly, repeatedly, this is what we will do if you come right up to the Yellow River and threaten us. We just can't tolerate that. MacArthur ignored them. We were seriously defeated initially. The Marines held together as a fighting force and were able to fight south from Chosin Reservoir. They carried their wounded with them. They carried their dead with them because U.S. Marines never leave anyone behind as a kind of psychological priority that's different from the rest of our military. Incredible bravery and effectiveness by U.S. fighting men. Other American units were completely smashed to pieces. The 1st Cavalry had a mixed record, but they were devastated by the Chinese attack.
And many captured.
Yes, indeed. And POWs became a major issue then, as during Vietnam.
Right. In fact, this gentleman from Elkhorn, Grant McMillan, he was captured. And he was a prisoner of war, a prisoner of the Chinese for 32 months.
Yeah.
So we speak about that in this interview on Tuesday.
I'm glad to know that. Thank you.
And it's a fascinating film. And, of course, it also paints an incredibly bleak picture of this brutally difficult winter.
Yeah.
And these conditions in which the soldiers on both sides were trying to survive, let alone function as soldiers. What I wanted to ask you quickly about was the notion that in the wake of this surprising reversal, where we were really caught off guard by all of these, you know, many, many thousands of Chinese outnumbered us 10 to 1 in some cases. But it really helped shape so much of what occurred the rest of that decade in terms of our attitudes about communism and in terms of building up our own military.
Truman quite wisely picked General Matthew Ridgway as the ground commander to succeed MacArthur, a particularly sensitive appointment, as we can all imagine and understand. I was around him once when I was in college in 1965. I received an Army ROTC award to go to the Association of the U.S. Army Convention in Washington. It's basically the Army's lobby as well as fraternity. Fascinating for me, there was a huge hall full of men and women in uniform for their main dinner, and there was a big dais groaning with military brass. Mm-hmm. Maxwell Taylor just returned as ambassador from South Vietnam, a very distinguished combat leader in World War II and later, JFK's favorite general, very good-looking, intellectual sort of fellow. He gave a speech in favor of the big escalation that was then going on in Vietnam. Thunderous applause. Never believe the revisionists who argue that the Army was against that intervention the way it was handled. Huge. I remember being kind of physically shaken by it. Thunderous. Everybody on the dais stood up and gave him a standing ovation, except one old general at the end. And because I was a rather serious young man who haunted libraries and was always reading Time and Life and history books, that was Matthew Ridgway, who was not applauding. He knew what it was like to fight a land war anywhere on the continent of Asia.
Wow.
Good lesson, the human dimensions, and this veteran that you're having on, thank you.
Yeah.
He will communicate that.
Absolutely.
Very skillfully.
Right. It's easy to talk in vague generalities about something like the horrors of war, but
very cerebrally. And when you've all been around these people.
Yeah, and when you experience it directly, it's a whole different story. So again, that conversation will occur on Tuesday's morning show. It's already been recorded, and then that documentary that I mentioned, American Experience, will air Tuesday night on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country.
May I very briefly mention, speaking of upcoming events, that Carthage College is having Bruce Dumont, a serious media figure and an influential one from Chicago. He'll be originating his weekly TV and radio public affairs program, Beyond the Beltway, from Carthage from 5:30 to 8 p.m. on Sunday, November 6th, just before the election. The public is welcome. along with everyone else. You can RSVP too, literally, by email rsvp@carthage.edu. And we encourage people to attend. It'll be worth your time.
Very good. So I had him on my program a few years ago, and it was interesting to meet him. Interesting.
Always interesting. Yes, I can testify to that directly, Mr. Dumont.
Right. Professor Artsir, thank you so much for being here today on The Morning Show. Great pleasure.
Thank you, my friend. Likewise.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at